everybody, and welcome to another Books We Pretend to Read podcast. I'm your host, Gunnar Berger, and joining me today and for the next several episodes is my co-host, Jim Flannery. And Jim, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So those of you that listen to this podcast on a regular basis are probably familiar with my co-host, Chuck Caristas. This summer, I've got to have a stand-in co-host, which is Jim. And if you've been following our podcast from the beginning, yeah, you might know his name because he joined us for, was it the Lean Startup, Jim?
The Lean Startup, yep.
Yes. So that was a fun one. So Jim, thanks for coming back and being a part of this podcast with us. Today, we're going to be talking about a book called Monetizing Innovation by two authors whose names I'm not even going to attempt to tackle, but I'm sure the link will be somewhere in my podcast website. In any case, this book is about pricing and packaging. Now, on the product side, I've gone through launch cycles and I've had the pricing and packaging team brought into that cycle, but it's normally kind of towards the end as you're going through launch process. But that's not my specialty by any means. Jim, if you recall from the previous podcast, Jim's specialty is in startups and VCs. And actually, let me do a little bit more introduction on you, Jim, before we dive too much into it. So Jim is a lecturer at University of Georgia, which is in Athens, Georgia. And before that, Jim and I got to know each other because he started an incubator in Georgia called For Athens. And more importantly to me, he worked at ATDC, which is the incubator inside Atlanta, Georgia, connected with Georgia Tech, my alma mater. I won't get too much into the Georgia versus Georgia Tech discussion because there's really not much of a discussion to have there. We all know Georgia Tech's better. And as he's smirking at me. But yeah, that's a little bit about Jim. But we also have a third guest, as we typically do on our podcasts, because neither Jim nor I would claim to be a subject matter expert when it comes to pricing and packaging, which is where I brought in our director of pricing and packaging at Citrix, which is where I work, Brett Waldman. So Brett, say hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for coming, man. So this book came from you. I had a conversation with you, if you remember, I don't know, it was probably a couple of weeks ago, where I said I wanted to learn more about pricing and packaging. And you said this is kind of, I don't know if you said it's the Bible of it or not, but you definitely said this is like the go-to book for pricing and packaging. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Brett, is this the go-to book for pricing and packaging for people like Gunnar?
Exactly.
What? What's that? I don't even know what that's supposed to mean.
People that graduate from Georgia Tech.
Okay.
They need the basics explained to them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, I really didn't have the basics. In fact, at the beginning of the book kind of digs into like how people normally go about doing pricing and packaging. I'm like, oh, that's me. And it's like, oh, no, that's the example of how not to do it. I'm like, oh, oops. So yeah, thank you, Brett. I thought this was a very good book for someone like me who doesn't have a lot of experience in that world. Or at least my experiences is more on the R&D side. I work in the product group in the CTO office at Citrix. And I see a lot of the R&D and engineers building innovative products. But oftentimes this thing will get way down the runway before someone like you, Brett, would even be brought in to the conversation. So on that note, let's just dive into it. So this book has three main sections, but I'm going to focus the podcast mainly on part two, which in part two, they go over the 9 rules for successful monetization. And the main thing to summarize the entire book in a sentence or two is that they flip this paradigm of monetization on its head, for me at least. They start with the idea of how much is a customer's willingness to pay for a product and work backwards from that. I often just kind of focus on what's a problem that a customer has, and let's find out how to solve that problem for the customer. And the money stuff is going to come in. I'm not saying it's going to come in the 11th hour, but it definitely isn't going to be the first thing I think about in a typical product launch. In fact, in product launches I've done, Brett, I think you've been in some of those with me, in that conversation where you bring in the specialists like you to say, okay, what's the market? And you go through your typical market analysis to figure out what the pricing for and packaging for that product should be.
Well, Brett, I really want to hear your opinion on a lot of this, because what Gunnar just explained, which was, you identify a customer problem and then you figure out the pricing later, seems intertwined with this concept of, willingness to pay. They abbreviate in the book as WTP all the time. It seems like they gloss over that, you have to identify a problem first. And so before you even can talk about, is someone willing to pay, you've got to figure out that problem piece. And I just wonder if those concepts that Gunnar, you seem to be making them sound as if they're divorced a little bit, are not divorced, and that friction between the two does not seem to be resolved in this book, which is how do you identify if you actually have a problem? And only then can you talk about, is someone willing to pay?
Well, you know, I think they use the phrase that customers talk with their feet, right? If they're not willing to pay for it, did you really solve a big enough problem for them? Right. I mean, that's at the end of the day, that's the issue. It's like you solved a problem for them. You know, maybe you did solve a problem for them, but maybe that was a bug bite and, you know, they're not going to go pay for an over the counter, you know, itch reliever. Right. You know, Jim, in the startup world, right, you always hear, is it a Tylenol or is it a cancer drug that you've created? And how you price Tylenol versus cure for cancer are going to be very, very different. So to Gunnar, to your point, it does flip the whole problem solving on its head, but it's coming back to the same thing is, am I actually solving a problem customers are willing to pay for? So just, you got to think about that in terms of that entire continuity.
Well, yeah, it really looks at it in a different approach of what I've seen in that the willingness to pay, which is going to be something we say probably way too much on this podcast, is the starting point. And I don't disagree with it. I think it's a smart thing to look at. But I also see that the structures I've seen in more developed products, more developed companies, is they already have a customer base. They already have a set price for that customer base. I don't get the opportunity to go reset that every time I want to add a feature to a product. But at the same time, I respect what they're saying in this book, which is that every feature should have a corresponding price to it, right? Or you're missing something. Like because that's how they prioritize features is what is the customer's willingness to pay for this feature? And they have, you know, the example of Porsche that basically stripped out every single feature they could from their, I can't say it. Is it Cayenne? Is that how you say that?
I never have any idea.
The Porsche SUV, I'll say that. They basically figured out what are the key features that the customers were willing to pay for. And then everything else, we're just going to have it as a option on that car. So that is where I kind of struggle with this thing, because everything has a price point, and the amount of work that you have to do, the amount of teams, like I guess this is probably what your team does, Brett, of understanding like the price point for every single feature. That's, I mean, crazy complex to have that type of focus groups, to have that type of thing. And I very much feel like that's what this book is advocating for, is that you should be doing that. And I don't disagree. I'm just kind of looking at like, how would I go about doing that for every single, I mean, the amount of surveys you have to go out, the amount of A/B testing you have to go out. I don't think anyone I know would say that's a bad idea, but I do think they would say, where's the budget to support this? But I feel like I'm really getting the cart in front of the horse here, that I'm, you know, getting towards end game on this book. But anyway, let's go back. So it starts out, the conversation is, what is the customer's willingness to pay? And I think there's a ton of value in starting at that point, because anyone, especially Jim in your world, anyone that's doing a startup, they have to create some type of financial analysis that at least shows like why I'm doing this. Why should you invest in me? If I'm building the next Uber app or whatever it happens to be, I have to have an idea of what customers' willingness to pay is going to be. They may not call it willingness to pay, but they have an idea of what the revenue forecasts are based upon something else. Now, I like how this book really digs into that more of really understanding your customer, because that's where I'm in love with the book, is I'm very much an advocate for the customer and understanding where's the customer at today. And what I haven't done, I think a lot of my approach has been what they call minimizing? I think that's minimizing.
They use the term minivation, I
minivation,
think.
Yeah, thank
minivation,
you.
Yeah.
So I think by my approach sometimes maybe looks at that standpoint, because I'm not as focused on what's the customer's full willingness to pay. But so here's the other struggle I'm going to have talking about this book. I read another book on Amazon at the same time. So this past week was in Venice Day. So I had two books with me. One of them was this one. One of them was another book for a different podcast. And I kept going back and forth because Amazon's approach was almost opposite of everything I read in this book, which is just crazy to me to see, like, to read these things in parallel unintentionally, where Jeff Bezos made some big plays back in the day in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s about just I'm just actually, he did it more recently when he bought a Whole Foods, where he just like, I don't care what the willingness to pay is customer, because obviously Whole Foods was doing very well and they had very high price point on the products. And he just comes in and it's like, nope, I'm going to go and cut all the costs within this group. And now, again, that's a different podcast, but I did think it was really interesting to see like these different approaches, whereas the approach to this book, I will say, is how do you squeeze the most juice out of a lemon? That's kind of what I felt this book was all about, is we want to maximize the customer's dollar amount that they're willing to pay. That's why one of their favorite examples they use is Uber, because Uber basically uses supply and demand algorithm to maximize the amount of money that you're going to pay. But it's a win-win for both sides of that.
Well, so this is actually, unlike Gunnar, I am not a big fan of this book. And I think that the Uber example is such a poor example on two fronts. One, there's actually been a study done that shows that Uber leaves a lot of value on the table. And so if you take this concept of the minivation, they are a prime sort of problem there, which is they are underpricing what they're doing. The second piece of it is they're just not profitable.
And well, I think that the only way, or the fact that they've not made any money,
the only way they get profitable is by automating all of this. And who knows where that is? You know, I hope it's tomorrow, but it doesn't seem like that's likely. And so they're basing a lot of the premise of this book on, I think, a terrible example, Uber.
Well, Uber, they use that as an example of penetration pricing, right? And so, which is, they do say it's a double-edged sword. And, you know, Uber's got a lot of market share by, like you said, leaving money on the table. But what they were able to do, which I do think was really nice, was, you know, they had a two-sided marketplace and they're trying to figure out how do they, you know, get the most supply while keeping demand, get the most demand while keeping supply available, you know, get more riders while always having a driver somewhat available, which not an easy thing to solve for.
Yeah, I think that ignoring the revenue of Uber, the innovation of Uber is, I think, what Brett's getting to is the intersection of those two markets. The fact that it's a win-win. It is truly a win-win when it's really busy on the roads right now, so their supply is super high, or whatever. It's rush hour, or whatever. The demand is super high, but they needed to find a way, and this is where innovation came of, how do you increase supply to meet the demand on the fly? And I think that's largely, and that's a monetization model. And that's what this whole book about is, you know, monetizing innovation. So really, I think it does fit really well with what they're trying to do. It's, hey, we found out that we can win both sides. We could increase the cost, thus reducing the supply, but also by increasing reducing the demand. I keep getting it backwards. We could increase the cost, which reduce demand, because some people are going to be price sensitive and they're going to, you know, it's too much money. I've done that on a surge pricing day. I'm like, no, I'm not spending that kind of money. But on the other side, because they've increased cost, they actually increase the supply because the drivers are going to be more willing to drive because they're going to get paid more per hour to drive at that time. That is crazy innovative within that industry. It's not necessarily a new idea. You know, we see this across hotel chains, like try to get a hotel whenever there's a conference in town, right? Matching your supply demand curve, or quantity supplied, quantity demand, my economics professor would want me to clarify that. Matching that curve, that's a really difficult thing to do. And the fact that they did that is where the innovation, I think, comes out. Ignoring the fact that the book does typically put them on a pedestal of, you know, being this awesome everything.
I agree with all of that. I do agree that it was very innovative on their part, but we don't know if it worked yet. And I think that that's the struggle and the challenge. And that was also, though, what I found interesting about the book is that there is a lot of these, I find this in most of the business books, and that's why I find this podcast interesting to listen to, even if I'm not talking about it, is that, you know, there is no hard science around a lot of this stuff and what we're looking for. What are the better models that work, and how do we create a more perfect model? And so this is an attempt at it, and I find pieces of it very fascinating, and
At some point in the book, they talked about having a play for success and having a play for failure, and they use this metaphor of, if you're playing chess, if you're only thinking one move ahead, you've already lost the game, because a good component's going to, or a good opponent is going to be thinking 5-6 moves ahead. Your big thing is, like, a lot of these different books are selling shovels during the gold rush, right? I remember you saying that on a previous podcast. And so just your comment right there that, you know, these books, they, no one has it right. There's not a perfect science, and you're right. But what I think about it is, if you are a good chess player, you actually study chess. You study the different moves, the different philosophies, whatever, and how you win the game, right? And that's kind of what I think about these different books, is that one book might be the 4-hour work week, which is all about, you know, minimizing the amount of work that you do, and trying, you know, a future book I'm doing with Dane Young is going to be The Company of One, which is a very similar vein of that. And then, you know, this book is about focusing on pricing strategies and how you innovate using pricing strategies. So each of these things, I tend to typically like them, because I look at them as, we're all trying to find success, right? And these are all different strategies for that success. But maybe this strategy and what this book offers might be good for your company, and you're 7 years old as a company. Had you tried it year one, it'd have been a huge failure. Maybe that Tim Ferriss book would have been a better book, and the strategy in that book would have been better for you. Or maybe Lean Startup would be a good philosophy for you. But I think it's good to have the different moves in your head, so when things aren't working out because you've been following one philosophy and maybe it's kind of played its course, you have this other one to pull out. So that's kind of how I think about this stuff. There is no one size fits all.
Yeah, and
absolutely.
This book, I think, is good, is that it's a good framework to start to think about your pricing, your packaging. You know, there's a lot of things it does not cover. Like, what's your sales strategy look like? What does your channel strategy look like? How do those overlay with your pricing, your packaging? And so there's a lot more complexity that gets overlaid on top of here. And, you know, like, this is just a good starting point for people that, you know, like Gunnar, who's like, hey, I want to learn more about pricing and packaging, and start to think about it, you know, more early on in the process, which is really at the end of the day. And they say this in the book as well. It's not what you sell, it's how you sell it. That's ultimately what you need to get to, is get to the model of how you're going to sell this effectively. And then your pricing, you know, that will also affect your net landed price.
Absolutely. And so I think that's sort of, this is a great jumping off point. And you just need to go a lot. You can go a lot deeper, almost into every subheader and every chapter. Yep. And write an entire book on how do you do a lot of this stuff. I think there's a lot of, you know, front end loaded stuff that's problematic here, which is, you know, how do you even talk to your customers? I thought one of the interesting concepts that they talk about is flipping how you think of buckets of customers on your head, because we teach a lot of our, you know, young entrepreneurs to think about demographics as it relates to customers, whereas they're talking about put them in willing to pay buckets. And I find that concept interesting, and I'd love to have a whole book written on just how do you create those processes, because they're a lot harder than just go out and talk to some customers.
Well, yeah, the whole talking to customers thing seemed glossed over throughout the book. It's like, go talk, go talk, go talk. And it's like, man, do you realize how difficult it is to get customers to, one, to the cost of that, just to go and get in. One, they give in a description of actually going into the mines, like one of their people had to go because they made the gas.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Mines. And it's like, man, that's expensive, right? I realize it's great data, but it's also really expensive to go get those type of people, and actually to get enough sample size that actually would be representation of your entire audience. That's even more expensive.
Also, and if we're talking about book recommendations here, talking to humans is actually a really great primer on that. It's a free book. I think it's even a PDF online, but I found that one of the best ways to start thinking about how do you actually just go out and talk to people.
All right. So willingness to pay, we've talked about that at this point in time. And in case we didn't give a very clear definition of it, willingness to pay is quite simply determining, if I have a Coca-Cola right now to Jim and I said, hey, you want this Coke? It's kind of hot down here, and you might be willing to give me a standard dollar for it. But if it was 100 degrees and we're outside at some picnic area and we're hot and sweaty, you might be willing to pay me $5 for the same thing. So willingness to pay is understanding the context as well as the customer. So, and they have lots of good examples of that. So that's that. Moving on to one size fits all solutions. Like it or not, your customers are all different. And that's kind of what Jim was just alluding to, is how he teaches his students segmentation. To me, there wasn't a whole lot of new stuff in that chapter. Brett, is there anything that you felt like on segmentation that really needed to be, that was interesting or new or different?
I thought what was different about the segmentation to what Jim alluded to was, they said, don't segment based off of your standard, you know, company size, geo. Do it based off of their different needs and willingness to pay, which is a really, really hard exercise. At the end of the day, pick some segments. If you can get to the point where you can actually understand the different needs and values and segment them appropriately, you've done an awesome job. But what I'm doing is just to pick a couple of segments and then start to see how they differ and how you may want to differ either your go-to-market strategy or your pricing strategy based off of those segments.
I think that that was one of the more simple concepts in the book, and also I think one of the more profound and probably very difficult to actually put into practice.
Speaking of difficult, I'm looking at page 55 here, where it actually gives you how they did segmentation. And again, segmentation to me is healthcare versus SLED versus, you know, small business or something. That's typical segmentation for our verticals, I guess. They are breaking it down, and I'm going to give you a picture of this in your head, is they basically did it by feature. So they said, what are the features that you need? You know, A, B, C, and D. Speed of delivery, you know, tech support. How important are these features to you? And then they took that, broke down the different segments of how people answer that. Like, there were certain people that said, the most important thing for us was price and price only. So that's a segment. That's your people in the air travel. Think travel industry. I'm terrible. I'm, you know, the cheapest one, basically your coach class. All you care is price. You don't care if I have a bag. I don't care if, you know, you don't give me any food or anything else. Price, price, price. That's that segment. But within that same thing, you've got the, you know, the eco plus, the business and first class. That's that segmentation based upon features. Like, do you want a good dinner? Well, that's a first class feature, right? So they break it down, and this data, just looking at this picture they have in figure 5.1 here, it's awesome. But again, the book kind of glosses over that, like how you go get that data.
Well, don't forget that this was written by a consultant.
Well, so Brett, what maybe selfishly to hijack the conversation here a little bit, I think this seems clear to bucket based on this willingness to pay when you have a known customer base, or you have a known customer base that you're trying to sell a new product or service into. Can you talk at all about how you do this when the customer is not known or is completely new? So you've gotten to Gunnar's point of, like, I think I've identified a problem. How do you go about segmenting at that stage?
Well, I mean, the first thing you have to figure out is, you know, who's the buyer? Is there anyone willing to pay for it? You got to go out and talk to prospects, and let's say I got some widget. Is that widget going to work for a marketing person? Is it a finance person? Is it HR? You know, is it someone in IT? Who is that buyer? You have to come up with some sort of hypothesis and, you know, start with your simple questions of, does this solve a problem for you? If you can apply the scientific method even better, like, you know, I think this will do X for you.
And so you're advocating here just really basic customer discovery, which can be a volume game over a more specific target game. Do you agree with that?
It all depends on where you're starting from. Like, it's so hard to be very specific here because the answer, as always, is it depends, right? It does solve, go back to kind of the whole idea of having the MVP, right? You don't want to put too much effort in without actually understanding what problem you're solving and customers agree to that. But you want to be able to convey what you're solving for in a very simplistic and a fast manner. And yeah, sometimes you can do that over PowerPoint or a video or something to that effect. But when you're first in your early days, have something customers can really touch, and especially if you're a startup and they don't really trust you, you got to have something that they can start to get trust from and see some value immediately and understanding where that value is and does that solve their problem. And more often than not, it solves a problem, but it may not be the problem that you thought it solved.
Well, let's move on, because we're already 5 minutes over in the first three chapters and we've only really touched the first two. But I know we're bouncing around in different areas. Let's the final chapter in our first of the three chapters, when designing products, configuration and bundling is more science than art. And the main thing I remember getting out of this chapter was the equation that they had on the breadsticks and the pizza. So you had a group of people that were willing to pay X for pizza, they're willing to pay X for breadsticks. And this was about bundling and how you could actually bundle to make things, make people spend more money. They gave a different example of, you know, segment A here, and each segment's 100 people. Their willingness to pay for pizza was $9, but their breadstick was $1.50. The second segment was $8 for the pizza and $5 for the breadsticks. Third one was $4.50 for pizza and $8.50 for breadsticks. So they really wanted those breadsticks. And the final one was $2.50 for pizza and $9 for breadsticks. It's giving you a standard business class question to answer of how do you maximize your profits from this group? And this one is just, I like math, and I like that, you know, this whole thing, the name of the chapter is, it is a science. This is not an art form. This is a science. And it's giving you a great example of, you've got two different groups that have, you know, that Venn diagram overlap between the two. How do you maximize? How do you set the pricing? Because you can't set the pricing at $8.50 for breadsticks and $9 for pizza and go home because you're leaving money on the table. I mean, you can do that. And you will make X, but this whole, the whole point of this chapter in this book is that by doing that, you're leaving a lot of money on the table. So it teaches you by setting the, you know, buy one, get the second item for $2.50 more, whatever the math ended up having to be, you end up getting both groups, the bulk of the money from each group on the pizza and the breadsticks, but you also were able to capitalize on that extra income that they may not otherwise have bought the breadsticks with the pizza or vice versa. That's it. That's all I got for this chapter. I thought it was just an interesting chapter on how you bundle to make things better. But I'm way over on time for the first segment here, so let me pause for a quick commercial break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We are going through the monetizing innovation, and we just finished the first three chapters of willingness to pay, not building one size fits all solution by doing segmentation, and one I skipped over really quickly, which was the science of bundling to make more money. So the next chapter we're going to go on is called Go Beyond the Price Point, Five Powerful Monetization Models. So the five monetization models, the first model is a subscription model, which if you don't know what a subscription model is, I don't know why you're listening to the podcast at this point in time. Everything I feel like is a subscription these days. My Adobe, I mean, heck, the thing I'm recording on right now is Adobe Audition. Guess how I own that subscription model? It's, you know, very common model in that it's a recurring revenue model. It's actually something I talk to my wife a lot about because she's a veterinarian. And eventually she's going to start her own business one day. And I've told her right from the get-go that I want recurring revenue as part of the model. And there's some good models out there to borrow from for that, because there's very little pet insurance out there right now. There's some, but I like the idea of you just pay a monthly fee, then when your cat or dog has an issue, you come in, and it's kind of this, and I like this recurring model. So a subscription. Dynamic pricing, is this the Uber one? I feel like that's Uber, which we've already talked about a little bit. Dynamic pricing model is basically you're adjusting based upon supply demand curve. The demand goes up, supply goes down, you increase your pricing,
and it makes a lot of people angry.
Oh yeah.
The good example in the book was Coca-Cola actually attempting dynamic pricing at their vending machines.
They on their digital machines, they tried to make it so if the weather was hot, the price of the Coke went up, which is genius and idiocy all at the same time, right? It's super smart, but it obviously didn't fly. In the case, this is where I go back to the Uber conversation. The thing about the Uber surge pricing, the reason why, while it does tick me off from time to time, is that it does solve that issue of there is a limited supply. And if I need to get where I'm going, I'd much rather be able to get there and pay a higher price than just to be screwed.
Well, so, I mean, it goes back to the core tenet of this book, which is understand your customer. And they understood that their customer wanted to open the app and see cars rather than open the app and see no cars. And yep. So you're willing to pay that higher price because what you really care about is making sure that you can get a ride.
So number three was market-based pricing, or AKA auctions, which should be pretty self-explanatory. This is the eBays of the world. The fourth one is alternative metric pricing, pay as you go. So I think Amazon is probably one of the best examples I can think of for this, in that, you know, the cloud and the idea that if I'm running, if I need some kind of service, I can just use a pay as I go instead of needing to buy potentially millions of dollars of infrastructure and software and everything else. I can just reach in through an API and grab what I need, and I'm only charged as I use it. So I think that's a pretty popular model. And the final pricing model is freemium, which is every single pitch I'm sure you hear is the freemium model, which is that we'll give it away for free and then we'll find a way to monetize it later.
Because you're lazy and you don't want to do
so
the work.
My only issue there is that freemium is not a pricing model. Freemium is a marketing model. And so if you're, you know, freemium really is typically, right, in most startups is you get a free product and then you can pay for a subscription. And so if you've done any research around the product-led growth movement of late, freemium plays a heavy component there, but that's about delivering value to your customers very quickly. And freemium is a way of, it's just a cost of acquisition. Again, this book was published, I think, 3-4 years ago. So maybe, you know, maybe they'll come out with an update, but freemium, again, is not a pricing model. It's a go-to-market model. So that's just my one little tidbit on the whole freemium there.
The book does jump all over the freemium model later, because it talks very much about how you price your product and how freemium, you've boxed yourself into a corner, and that when you set your prices high, you can always come down. But when you set your prices low, it's very, very difficult to come up. In fact, they had an example of a car company, I think it was Mercedes, where they set their price too low and they had a huge demand because of it. But they had to increase the price of the car only, I think, 3% each year, even though they knew by all the metrics after the fact they should have charged 20% more. But they couldn't just switch around and change it to 20% overnight. That's what Elon Musk does, causes an uproar. They had increased it 3% for several years before they can get back to that thing. And the book said it cost them hundreds of millions of dollars because of that. So I think the book does a pretty good job in agreeing with you, Brett, in that it's, yes, the freemium model might be something that's out there, but by and large, this book comes off to me as, don't do that. You want to start high, and if you have to pull the brakes, okay.
I'm not saying don't do freemium. I think there's a valid market for freemium, but you gotta, you know, this comes back to, you need to understand the willingness to pay by feature very early on. And you gotta, and this is where terminology can be a little bit different. I call it, this is where the packaging is more important than the actual pricing, right? I mean, Evernote's a great example, right? Evernote didn't really understand where the willingness to pay was on the different feature sets. And then a few years ago, if you remember, like they changed up their pricing and packaging, and then they moved to a model where the free version limited to only 2 devices. And now you're limiting my access on multiple devices, which was, you know, to me, that was a value for me, but not something that I was willing to pay for. Whereas some of more of the advanced features, maybe like the PDF search, unlimited storage up to, you know, they do some ridiculous high amount of storage I get in here. You know, that might have been, hey, maybe they should have reduced the storage that they included at the free level and then gotten me to pay more when I reached a certain limit. And so that's where it comes back to, again, understanding your customer's willingness to pay by feature or feature sets, and then packaging that appropriately. And if that entry-level package happens to be free at low cost, it has to be able to be a pull model where the customer just buys or pulls it, and kind of think of the e-commerce model. And the higher level tiers can be more sold. You know, that's where your salespeople would come in and come into that push model.
So speaking of the freemium model, I'm actually using the freemium model right now. And you and I, I'm recording you over a product called Zencastr. Interestingly enough, I used to pay for it. I think it has like a $20 a month premium SKU. And I used to pay for it and I ended up shutting it down and just using the free SKU, which is what we're using right now. The big difference product-wise or feature-wise is that I'm recording you in MP3 format only. In the premium SKU, I was able to get you in waveform. And I don't know. After this podcast, I'm going to find out real quickly, was that a bad call? That should I have captured you via waveform? The other options that they have is that I can have multiple people. So maybe if I had multiple remote guests, I would go back to paying for Zencastr. But anyway, I to your point, freemium is good to maybe these people captured me as they wouldn't have been able to capture me as a potential customer in the future. But there's that need to understanding of you don't want to give away the farm, right? And right now, it's the product and its freemium SKU pretty much works for what I need it to do. And I think that's where potentially other products run afoul, and Evernote being a good example of why, what are the additional features that are going to speak to me and actually make me get out my credit card for that product. That's chapter 7. Chapter 8 is price low for market share or high for premium branding. Pick the winning pricing strategy.
Well, so there are sort of three key bullet points here, which was you can either go for maximization, penetration, or skimming, and figuring out sort of which of those matter for you and your business. And I thought that was a really great, simple way to think through how you consider your price here.
So what were those again?
Maximization.
What is that?
That is trying to capture as many people as possible.
Okay. Second one.
And Brett, you can add some color here if you want. If I'm getting these
wrong. I thought maximization was getting the most value out of it. Penetration was getting the most people.
Yes, there you go. Why don't you take over? You're the expert here.
Oh, no. Then, I was going to say skimming. I can't remember what they called what the definition of skimming was. So I was looking forward to hearing that.
So skimming, in my mind, is where you, and this is a core concept, I think, when we deal with startups, which is you charge your, what we call our ICP, our initial customer persona, we charge them more because they're willing to pay more for it. And then later you introduce a product that is more to the general market that is cheaper.
So this is maybe not a perfect example, but Tesla, right? If you wanted a Model 3, the only way to get a Model 3 was to get the most premium Model 3 out there, which was $60,000+. And it was only, 2 years after they launched Model 3 that you can finally get into the $30,000 range. So it's skimming is you want to get all the people that have the highest willingness to pay, get them, because that's also most likely your highest profitability, profit people, and then slowly coming down to get more and more audience that are more price sensitive.
And so Peter Thiel has a great blog on this, I believe it's him, where he talks about you use the profit from these initial early adopters, these ICPs, which allows you to continue to refine the product. You pour that excess money that you make from them back into the product to make it more generally acceptable to the mass market. And finding these people, I think, is both one of the most important things in talking about willingness to pay and also one of the hardest things to do. Who are really the people who are the least price sensitive and are willing to pay almost anything to get the product?
Apple makes their entire business model off of this, right? They have the new whatever iPhone that's golden, yeah, you're holding it. It takes a year or more before they make the more cost efficient model. It's fairly common. I unfortunately am in the category of gimme, I need it now. I don't want to be in that category, but I'm a nerd. I want the latest fancy gadget. So those are we talked about monetization models. We talked about premium pricing and working our way back, winning pricing strategy. And let's do chapter 9, from hoping to knowing, building an outside-in business case.
So I felt that in this chapter, there was the 9 steps to building a living business case. And I think really the core takeaway here is just these documents should be living, meaning always willing to change. You never have perfect data. You never have enough data. Take the data that you have, start moving forward, refine as you go along.
outside in is really important, because a lot of times you'll see business cases built around, oh, IDC or Gartner says this market's going to be $100 billion in 5 years, right? And, you know, and we've talked to these five customers and they love this idea. You've told me nothing about, you know, the customer's willingness to pay. Yeah, they love the idea. Does that mean they love it at a dollar a user, or do they love it at $1,000 a user? What's the sales forecast look like? What's the margins end up looking like based off of that willingness to pay? You know, tell me more. You know, if you're just giving me that, oh, I, you know, this looks great, I know I would use it, IDC and Gartner says this market's going to blow up, you're not telling me enough information about what the customer is really telling you. And again, that's where, if you kind of go back to chapter one, understanding that willingness to pay early is really, really important, because are they willing to pay a dollar, or are they willing to pay $1,000 for that feature? That's very much going to affect whether that, how that business case will turn out.
So again, what I struggle with here is that oftentimes, and Brett, this is really true in our industry, is that we already have the product on the market, right? It already has a set price. We're not, by building this next feature, for me to go and say we should change the price of the product, give me a break. I'd be laughed out of the room. And also on top of that, to have the data that actually would show, if we build this product or build this feature to a product that, you know, a customer's willingness to pay is $5 more. Okay, let's look at any product that you are currently spending, or Netflix. Here's a good example. Netflix, you know, it's 14 bucks a month or whatever. And you could come up with the next greatest feature of something for Netflix. Would it really matter if you could determine that it's 20, is Netflix going to come out with another SKU to try to eke out that 25 cents more? I think this is a common problem with most companies. And then this book just kind of skims over it. And it's just like, you need to figure out how much you're willing to pay for that product, which is great from an internal conversation standpoint of to look at willingness to pay as a way to measure which features I should build. Seems fantastic to me if I could actually have that information on what the willingness to pay
but,
is.
You just used the perfect example, Netflix. They raise prices every other year. Like, they come out with, you know, little new features all the time. They don't necessarily monetize it on day one, because they know that, you know, they can't just raise prices like Tesla does every random day. They come back and they say, you know, all right, I've introduced download offline. You know, I can download these movies offline now. Awesome. You know, oh, I've got a little bit higher 4K video now. Awesome. Oh, by the way, at your next renewal event, the price is going up a dollar. Oh.
So do you think that comes out of that willingness to pay?
That's, you know, they're pushing, you know, and again, it's, I mean, more of that willingness to pay is around their content strategy. So again,
I would say that there's a ceiling to this thing, because yeah, you're right. They have been creeping up and up and up and up, but that there's a ceiling, and I'm sure they know that ceiling better than anybody, but it doesn't matter what, and this is what I was trying to get at. It doesn't matter what feature I add. Once you're at that ceiling, which I would say Netflix is definitely creeping into that area. You're in a bad spot, because now your willingness to pay, you've already hit the ceiling. I've got this great feature. So what do I do? They just try to, I think Netflix's main focus has been acquiring new customers because they scale really well. Do you think someone at Netflix, and this may be true, looks at Stranger Things and says, Stranger Things is worth 5 cents more per customer? Because that's kind of how I would read the book, saying how we should approach that. Stranger Things, I'm looking at this as now a feature, so to speak, right, in this context. So here's this feature. It's called Stranger Things. Is that worth 5 cents more per customer? Now, I'll tell you, it's one of my favorite shows, so I would say yes to me. But I do think that eventually those nickels and dimes, they add up and they're going to hit a ceiling, in which case you start questioning, is that subscription worth it?
No, it absolutely, you'll reach a ceiling at some point, and then it comes back down to cost. I mean, there was an article on Netflix just the other day where they're saying that, you know, they're finding that the optimal experience for customers for expanding to new customers and retaining them is 2 seasons of a show. And that also, coincidentally or not, is when the showrunners typically ask for a raise after season two. So now that now there's a big, you know, it's like, oh, is Netflix going to, you know, there might be five seasons of Stranger Things, but most shows on Netflix now, we should expect to see only two seasons because it's not going to be the margins on producing that third season, even if it's a moderately successful series, will not make it worth it for Netflix.
So I think that Netflix is probably one of the best customer data driven companies in this regard. And I bet they have figured out how to quantify what a show is worth to any individual user. But I think most companies don't even come close to figuring out pricing.
Yeah. They should really segment me and realize I will not watch anything drama. And so they should have a drama category for those people. And it could save some money for me. I'm just kidding.
The enterprise, just to your point about the enterprise sales, right? You know, certainly when you talk about, you know, when enterprise sales was mostly perpetual software, adding a new feature, most customers expected that to be included in that platinum edition. And so you have that platinum value add question of, oh, you know, hey, we're going to add more value here to platinum, which will hopefully get customers to go from that standard advanced to platinum, but also maybe it increases our landed ASPs. You know, we don't necessarily change our list price, but we increase our renewal price, and that may be effective or may not be. Now that we've moved to more of a subscription-based model, do those features now still have to be in that platinum edition? Could it be a platinum edition plus some sort of add-on? You know, there's a lot of flexible configurations and that you should have as you think about the different segments that you sell to.
Let me jump off of that, because that brings us to our next chapter pretty well, which is the next chapter is innovation won't speak for itself. And they've got a couple of pictures in this book, which made me laugh when I first read them, because anyone that's ever seen me on stage, I try to tell a story. When I present, and oftentimes I'm working with a PM or some product manager out there that's got, here's, you know, version 8.7 of our product, and look at all this stuff that we've done, and it just is this big long checklist, which the book shows exactly that is this huge list of all of these features. And so the title is Innovation Won't Speak for Itself, and that's it. And what they're getting at here is that if you're selling feature, and that's all you're doing is this matrix of features, that doesn't say anything. It doesn't help. It actually makes it more difficult for customers to make a purchase decision. And it shows an example of this company that went from these four different packages with the typical, you know, pricing that follows those different packages. And, you know, these four different packages used to have 100+ features that they would show. So here you are, Mr. Customer, interested in this new feature, or this, which one should I buy? And here's, you know, 100 features I got to look at and compare, versus the consultants of this book came out and removed them all and just focused on value. And this is actually something we haven't talked that much about in the podcast so far, but I think is core throughout the book, is we're not talking about pricing. We're talking about value. Yeah, we are talking about pricing, but in talking about it in the context of value, what is the value that I'm bringing to the customer, and how do you capture that value? And if you can figure out how you capture that value, that's how you then turn it around as your pricing story. There's a story that comes in later in the book where Optimizely. They were trying to figure out how to charge for their products. They have different products. And the standard way to do it was per user. For them, they're like, that doesn't make much sense to us, because there's probably only one or two people inside the organization that would use this piece of software, but it benefits a lot of people. And so they determined that for one of their products, they were going to do it based upon the usage. It was for website optimization, and they would do A/B testing. And they basically say, anytime you run a test, Basically, we can show which site is getting better performance. And this company was founded because they were doing it for the Obama campaign and were able to raise over $100 million more donations into the Obama campaign because they determined that a picture of Obama in black and white, along with a button that said learn more, not a button that said, you know, give me your email address or whatever it was. They found out by putting those two together, they have 40% better interaction rate. I'm messing up the proper term. In any case, they were able to very clearly see that this work they did brought in $100 million. There's the value that they're bringing into the organization. Now, you can't charge $100 million for that. But they then said, this is a great idea. Let's build a company around it. And that's how they wanted to capture their value, was basically, you use this tool to do your A-B testing. We're going to charge you based upon the usage of that, which is just simple, you know, website hits. I don't know if it was pennies or whatever. They didn't talk about like what the actual equal to dollars was for us. But that I liked how they really focused on what is the value that our product brings to the customer, and let's align how we charge people to that value. So you're not just coming with an arbitrary, you know, bottoms up, what's our cost plus model? You know, if it costs us $4 million to make it, let's, you know, charge $5 million. No, what is the value that we're bringing to the customer, we're able to capture and measure it? I think that's an important part of this too. I think KPIs comes up in another chapter, is how can you capture that value and measure it? So it's something very easy for an end customer to see. If I didn't have this software, I would not have got this revenue. Right. So that was their entire monetization strategy. But I'm sorry, I've jumped ahead. Let me jump back to where I was, which is this company that had literally 100 different features. And they're talking about how just having those features caused so much confusion that they ended up losing customers. And it talked about some customers just always want the premium feature, period. That's just who they are. And that's your skimming customers at the top. They want the highest everything. And so they create different price points for this customer. In fact, well, one example they gave was a customer that had realized the willingness to pay for somebody was $99, but they were charging $79. The next level up was $199 was the cutoff, but they were charging $149. All they ended up doing is simplifying the message, not showing 100 features, showing the value, the three value propositions for each of these different levels. They increased the price and they set a new price of $300. So before, their highest one was $150 or $149, and the new one is $300. And they had people only like 4 or 5% buy the $300 one because they just assumed it was so much more expensive. They wanted the premium thing and they're just going to buy the premium offering. And there's always a small amount doing that. That whole story is one of the things and why I say I like this book, because it taught me about anchor pricing and it taught me about how you really can manipulate people's emotions, which is bad, but this is what apparently people like you do, Brett. I'm blaming you, to get more money, right? If someone feels that there's more value just because it costs more, then take the money and run.
Okay. So you're talking about chapter 11 where they're talking about behavioral pricing tactics. I thought, you know, there was one really great example in talking about creating messaging where they talked about Carbonite. And this was a really clear highlight of, we talk about benefits and not features. And this is something that I see young companies struggle with all the time. Carbonite used to have on the website that you'd get 20 gigs for free or for the lowest price. But nobody knows what that means. But I'm sure when they all sat in a room, they thought, that's not a feature, that's a benefit. You're going to get 20 gigs. And changing that to unlimited storage much more clearly articulated the value and the messaging and the actual benefit that you were going to get. And I find tweaks like that just constantly. I used to use Optimizely all the time. I haven't used it in years. But we used to do this all the time with websites. Changing simple words, simple phrasing, simple messaging would increase conversion 30, 40, 50% almost immediately. Crazy to see. Yeah, and it was really cool. I love Optimizely. I haven't used it in a while, but I think it's phenomenal.
I think a lot of this, and so I'll just start talking about behavior stuff because the behavioral stuff was just amazing to me to learn. One example they gave in the book, you go to a movie theater and you see the small Coke for $6. And then you see the large Coke that's like 14 gallon cup size. And that one's $7. And, you know, mentally, if the only thing up there was a $7 Coke, you would say that is ridiculous. Why does anyone want to spend would anyone accept $7 of a Coke? But because they did this thing called an anchor price of a small Coke. They don't want anyone to buy that thing. They probably don't even have small cups inside the store. They put that there's an anchor price. So when you see the other one, it seems like a great deal. And I bet every single person listening to this podcast right now has done exactly that. You're not going to buy the stupid small that's an just outrageously bad deal. They did that on purpose. They know it's an outrageously bad deal. But then you look at the large and you think, oh, it's not too bad. $7 for Coke. No, that's $7 for Coke. This is a terrible deal. But anchor pricing is about manipulating your emotions to feeling like you're getting a good deal.
Brett, maybe this is revealing, you know, secrets of the pricing world. But how often do you explicitly talk about these six strategies that they mention in the book, compromise, anchor, price signal, quality, the razor blades, pennies a day, or price threshold concepts?
Explicitly? Very, very. Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things where you try to talk to an executive about it and you know, right over the head. I mean, this is where I was like, hey, if every executive read this book and nothing else on packaging, it'd make my life a lot easier and they'd understand a tenth of what I'm talking about.
I feel like that's aimed at me a little bit. Sorry, I love you, Brett. I'll tell you what, the thing I really liked that example of the ultimate premium SKU that had very little added value. It's just because mentally some people want the highest thing. And I feel like I'm the idiot that does that. I have a philosophy in life, which is buy once, cry once, which is buy the most expensive thing. You cry the one time you buy it and then you're happy. It works throughout its life. Whereas you buy the cheapest thing, you cry every time you use it. So buy once, cry once is a philosophy I use in life. And I just feel like, oh my gosh, how many people have screwed me because of that philosophy? Oh, no, I'll get the $300 SKU. I know I'm good. Right. And it didn't really have much better features. It's just
the whole world is opening up to you, Gunner.
Right? It's like, oh my gosh, buy the second one down, Gunner. I still won't be able to do it. It's just who I am.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to what Jim said, I mean, explicitly, you don't talk about these things all that often. Implicitly, they're in there. They're in the conversations. They're in the business case. They're in how I push back on product marketers, product managers when they come to me with a proposal. Like, hey, did you think about this or that? And maybe I'll go into a concept here or there. But again, trying to actually explicitly talk about these things on a day-to-day basis doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, we're running out of time. We only got a few minutes left in the podcast. I want to talk about maintaining your price integrity. And we talked about this a little bit earlier, how a lot of people will look at if I have my sales forecast is X and we hit X and then some, and you think, woohoo, that's a big win. They said, you actually need to examine that just as hard as you would examine the reverse, which is I had my sales forecast and we were beneath that. Now, if it's beneath it, now everyone knows you're going to jump into every bit of detail you can to figure out why do we miss our targets. But I thought it was really interesting, this idea that you need to have a game plan and you need to stick to it, which that's not really, you know, mind blowing or anything. But the idea is that when your game plan starts to fall apart, the knee jerk reaction, the easiest thing to do is to change your price. And they have very strong cautions against that, that it seems easy. And of course, every salesperson in your company is going to be calling you, arguing that the price is too high, the price is too high. When the book gives a lot of examples of how do you respond to that without responding to changing the price, because knee-jerk reactions on price can be problematic. And actually, we've talked about Tesla quite a few times, and I've had multiple Teslas now, and I hate how knee-jerky Tesla is to their pricing, because it affects the resale value of my car, which is a big deal on an expensive car like that. And when someone buys a car for X and then a month later it comes out and they've reduced the price by $15,000 because they're trying to hit some number for the quarter, it pisses you off, right? As someone who's already bought the product and very happy with the product, it then makes me mad about the product that I was happy about. So these knee-jerk reactions, they can cause confusion with your customers and they can get your customers to be very upset. And I can just speak very firmly about that in the Tesla mentality there. I think it's easier to read it in a book than it is to deal with it in the real world, because they gave examples in the book of what happens in the real world. of, you know, that you've missed, that a competitor saw that you're doing, that you're reducing your price, or maybe they did it. They do say that 90% of people believe, or 90% of businesses believe, that it was their competitor that started the price wars, which I thought was interesting. I said, that's impossible, statistically impossible, that it's always the other guy's fault, that oftentimes you don't realize that you are at fault for starting the price wars. So I thought that was a good thing to think about. It's like, what is your responsibility when you're launching the product? You've done all the work. You've brought in Brett Waldman, who gave you the best pricing and packaging strategy in the entire world. And then a month later, something's not going right. So you say, no, Brett was wrong. Let's change it. And they say, no, you should already have a plan in place of what you do when that occurs.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was a fantastic example in the book. The monetization team, the pricing packaging team, you know, at the end of the day, especially for an enterprise software company, is not going to be, you know, you get responsible for the, you know, the average or the median price integrity, but on that deal specific, you know, oh, I've got a $3 million deal, it's the end of the quarter, but the ASPs are really, really low. So it's a bad deal, you know, but it makes or breaks that quarter. I can't be, you know, I'm not in position to, yeah, I don't, I'm certainly not an executive level to make that call. You need somebody in sales to be able to have that position of power and to have that playbook of yes or no, you know, because really, yeah, maybe it's a $3 million deal, but really we should be a $5 million deal, and we're going to have to wait till next quarter, and we're going to have to, you know, talk to executives and Wall Street about why we missed, but you know, next quarter is going to be, you know, 40-50% higher pricing. You need to have that playbook in there. At the end of the day, it's a test of wills. So it's who's got the will to pull that off, you know, to say no to that $3 million deal at the end of the quarter. You know, I'd say most salespeople would agree to that deal and move on. But I thought that was a great example to make sure that you think about both bad deals and really great deals about, hey, we made so much money here. Did we underprice it? So that, you know, again, great chapter.
And on that note, we need to wrap this thing up. I would like to just kind of make some closing remarks on the book. So I'm really happy that you recommended this book to me, because it gave me a lot more insight to what you do, how pricing something and packaging something. I think I'm more familiar with the packaging, on to be honest. Like a lot of the stuff they talk about, features and packaging and value, that wasn't a new concept to me. But pricing and how you use that as an innovation strategy, that was new to me. And I really appreciate this book recommendation from you, because it allowed me to really see this in a light I had not seen before. So thank you for that. And also thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And on that note, Jim, thank you so much for standing in. And for those listening, we're going to get a lot more Jim over the next couple podcasts. I don't know if I talked too much about Chuck earlier on, but he's got some personal things going on over the next couple months. So Chuck, we're thinking about you. He'll be back. But for now, we have Jim, who is an outstanding stand-in for him. So thank you, Jim, so much for joining me.
Well, let's wait till we see the data.
Oh, it'll. Well, it's true. You should help me figure out how to even do the data. And on that note, actually, if you want to interact with us, please jump on the website, which is Books We Pretend to Read as an acronym.com. So BWPTR.com. You can actually send in little voicemail things through there. So if you have questions, comments, you're saying, Gunner, what you just said was stupid, I probably agree with you. But if you do that, let us do that, because then I could actually brand on air and we could respond to that, which I would love to do. Outside of that, we are on Twitter, Books We Pretend to Read as an acronym, BWPTR at BWPTR. Reach out that way. So I'd love to interact with our audience more. So thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Have a good one.